In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
C.S. Lewis once wrote that of all tyrannies, a tyranny sincerely exercised for the good of its victims may be the most oppressive. It would be better to live under robber barons than under omnipotent moral busybodies. The robber baron's cruelty may sometimes sleep, his cupidity may at some point be satiated, but those who torment us for our own good will torment us without end, for they do so with the approval of their own conscience. That, pretty much, is the left for you, in all their authoritarian Marxist glory. They know better than you how to run your life. They know better than the founding fathers who fought to guarantee your freedoms. But you don't need those pesky God-given freedoms when the left knows what you need, and you certainly don't need freedom. Senator Rand Paul, in his book, The Case Against Socialism, wrote, "Mao, Stalin, and Hitler didn't come to power promoting tyranny, they came to power promoting equality." And that's exactly right. But despite promises of equality, equity and fairness, social justice, it never ends up that way. Because to the left, it is more important to have power and to be in power than it is to give it away. That's what freedom is. The government gives away its power to the people. Freedom means the government doesn't have power. It gives you the power. And that's why the left's utopia of the government having all the power always fails. Things will be so much better if you just obey, because the left just knows so much better. Except, of course, as Reagan said, they know so much that isn't so, especially when it comes to fixing things. Take, for example, the Corvallis School District's decision to fix math. To make things equitable, they're now going to detrack math, no more high-track or low-track classes, which removes a student's ability to move at their own pace. It's a one-size-fits-none approach. Imagine already being a grade ahead in math, only to now be forced to pull back and relearn concepts that you learned last year. And if schools are worried about kids who already see themselves as dumb at math, just wait until those kids are stuck in the same class with all the advanced kids. You can almost hear their thoughts. How come I can't get this when all the other kids do? It's practically building in inferiority complexes. But parents aren't stupid. In an article about this from the Gazette Times, one parent said, "I think we're going to further create inequalities by doing something like this because families with resources are going to go do what they need to do." And right on cue, as a result of these changes, more parents started enrolling their children in private school, hiring tutors, or homeschooling. Today, we're going to continue talking about school choice, because rich people shouldn't be the only ones who can send their kids to any school they want. And that's something the left really hates, because they don't have the control when parents make the choices. I would like to welcome Mark Thielman back to the show. He is the superintendent of the Alsea School District, which is southwest of Corvallis, about halfway between Philomath and Waldport. He is also a Republican candidate for governor. Mark, it's great to talk to you again.
Well, thanks for having me back.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we wanted to have you back on to talk more about the effort to put school choice on the ballot in 2024. We had talked initially with Donna Kreitzberg 2 weeks ago about it. I knew that there was an awful lot more to unpack, so we felt you were probably the best one to talk about all this. And we also understand that you were involved in this effort to qualify it for the ballot. It's currently at stage one to get it past the first hurdle. What was your role in this?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I was the chief petitioner, obviously. And just so that the public understands, you know, when you sponsor a petition, your home address is put on every signature page. And just to show you the climate that we're in, there were many wonderful people that I would have been very happy to have sponsored this. But at the end of the day, there was a little bit of a fear factor because of the political climate that we're in.
Sure.
So step one was agreeing to be the chief petitioner and being willing to garner that risk. The other one was I sat down and kind of educated the whole school choice team on how school finance works, a little bit about how the unions interact with school finance, in particular, obviously, the OEA, but also the big district local unions like Beaverton and Portland Public. And then explain to them that, you know, how, the way that you want to craft this is a way so that the public schools don't directly straight up lose, that that there has to be something that creates a relationship. And that's a little bit of how the funding works. So the funding, when it's passed, the funding will roll through local school districts, and local school districts will then account for all the homeschool students they have in their geographic area, as well as all private school kids in their geographic area. And those kids will be priced into the system. And now if parents don't opt in to the program, which is, you know, if you opt in, you get funds that will roll through the school the local school district to an ESA account. But the school district will retain 20%, and that's consistent with how they do charter schools right now. And the goal of that is that, you know, obviously the big thing unions are going to say is this will bankrupt schools and they'll spend millions of dollars opposing it. But it's going to be harder for them to sell every school, local school union on this when some districts will actually benefit, because right now they receive no money for homeschool or private school kids.
So in terms of school choice itself, what does that look like right now in Oregon? How much choice do parents actually have if they wanted to send their kids to somewhere else?
Well, they have choice, but they have to, but they don't get any benefit. So if they want to withdraw from the public school system, they can do so. They can homeschool, or they can send their child to a private school, which they have to pay for, obviously. But they still have to pay taxes, and then their children don't receive any of the benefits of those tax dollars. So that's not exactly, I wouldn't call that equity, just to borrow a term from the Department of Education. And the thing is, in reality is, and you'll see it in the charter school world too, charter school's big complaint is, why are our kids worth 80% of full funding? And that relationship, once again, was set up to kind of help the sponsoring district, because they're going to, you know, technically they lose kids if an outside charter comes in, and that way they can retain some funding. And that was the kind of the winning rubric, if you will, to allow districts, to get districts over the hump to allow charter schools. And it'll be a similar thing here with this education savings account kind of concept with school choice.
So aside from the political realm of things, I can hear a lot of people out there maybe thinking, well, why doesn't all the money follow the kids? Because if the parents have to then pay for a schooling elsewhere, shouldn't they have all that money? Why does the local school get anything?
Well, that's a fantastic question. I think it's because, you know, we're coming out after almost 40 years of one party rule, in particular here in Oregon.
Yes, that's for sure.
And let's be real honest. I mean, the OEA and the SEIU are public unions, and the public unions fund most of or the candidates for the legislature or for statewide or public office that they fund. The majority of those people win office because of the money. And that maintains the, the division between homeschool and private school versus public, where public's kind of the big dog on the block.
Yeah,
so obviously, you know, people don't want that arrangement to be changed, and this school choice completely turns that arrangement on its head. What's so powerful is it puts parents in the position to be in complete charge.
Yes.
Whether they're in public school or private school, parents will always have options with this school choice. They're not going to be landlocked or pigeonholed or forced to submit their kids to curriculum and things that they don't believe in.
That's right. And I think that's really the genius of this, is that money really does follow the parents to give them an actual choice. All right, let's go ahead and take a break there. We'll have more with Mark Thielman talking about real school choice here in Oregon. And welcome back. We're talking with Mark Thielman. He's the superintendent of the Alsea School District, which is southwest of Corvallis. We're continuing a discussion, really, that started 2 weeks ago with Donna Kreitzberg, who spearheaded the effort to get school choice, real honest-to-goodness school choice, on the ballot. And Mark, we were talking before the show started, and just to give people an idea of why school choice is so important, as I mentioned in my opener, right now the Corvallis School District is changing how they are intend to teach math. Can you talk to our audience about this from a superintendent's perspective as to what's going on there?
Well, again, it's an example of ideology versus reality in terms of the way kids and families work. So what they're doing is they're applying what they call an anti-racist collectivist lens. And the thing is that, you know, I don't want to disparage the folks in Corvallis there. The people spearheading this truly believe that this is a righteous and moral and innovative opportunity to, you know, create transformation and change in the Corvallis School District. And I don't want to deprive them of that. I do want to, you know, but, you know, we still have a free country. So what I'm going to say is my personal professional opinion about why I don't think it's a good idea or why I don't think it's going to work. So I'll qualify it that way. And if you ever work with human beings, you know that you never have 100% in the world of human beings. No two people are exactly the same. And so you'll have kids that have innate skill with math, innate skill with writing or literature. Some kids are just natural poets. Some can pick up an instrument and learn very quickly, while others have to kind of work at it. And that's just something that is a commonly understood, or it's commonly understood in the vernacular of the world of parents. And if parents who have had more than one child know that each child is a little different, some have different talents and et cetera. So what they're saying is that math tends to be the big determinant for injustice, because kids that are good at math tend to go on and do well in society. And there's good correlation for that, obviously. If you're, you know, good at math and you end up in Boeing or working with Elon Musk on rockets, those jobs are high risk, and they have a high impact for anybody, you know, engaged in the rocketry. And naturally, they come with big wages, and that is good for supporting families, et cetera. So there are folks that say that is inequitable, because a disproportionate of kids of color don't achieve in those jobs. And so what they do is, instead of saying, how do we support more families and more families of color to help their children be successful or grow a passion for math or find their talents, instead of doing that, they're doing the opposite. They're saying all kids will be forced to learn at the same rate. They will all be taught the same thing, and therefore 100% of kids by the end of seventh grade will be ready for algebra, and then all kids will do well in algebra, and we will have now created a new generation of kids where there's no achievement gap of any kind, all because of this math program. I'm emphasizing, for the sake of helping people who aren't familiar with this understand, the Corvallis School District won't market it quite that extreme, but I really want people to understand that is what's driving this. And it's going to be a disaster, especially for kids who have math talent. We should be taking kids with talent and getting behind them.
Yep.
Yeah, and allowing acceleration so they don't get bored in school, so they don't become problems in terms of their behavior, which is something we do see in super bright kids or tag kids, talented and gifted, et cetera. So the Alsea School District has responded to the Corvallis Math Initiative by, we just posted for a full-time talented and gifted coordinator, and we're going to be expanding talented and gifted options in the school district, both for brick and mortar and our online kids. So wait till that hits the news.
You know, I just look at what they're trying to do there, and it's like you've got a track team, and a couple of people are obviously faster than the other ones. And so let's go ahead and make them drag a weight behind them so everybody can run at the same speed. This doesn't make logical sense. It doesn't make sense in the real world. And yet this is what they're doing to our kids. I am just floored by this. And you mentioned the notion of race. And of course, that's really such a hot topic right now across all of education, is critical race theory, that this is being promoted and pushed in our halls of education. And I was floored by what they said in that article, and we'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com. And she says this, quote, I was able to walk into classes and identify whether they were a low or a high track math class just based on the color of the student's skin. I mean, that is blatantly racist. Where is the peoples of color in that community saying, wait a minute, are you honestly saying that people of color are stupid and therefore you can walk in and see if it's a bunch of white kids that must be doing well versus kids of color suddenly, I guess they can't do math. Is that honestly what you're saying? I mean, that is horribly racist.
Well, you're making a lot of sense, and you have to be careful with that when you're dealing with critical race topics. So let me give you an example. They would view the same thing this way. They would say, look at the injustice in the system. And here we are unconsciously participating in the promulgation of disparity and inequitable outcome by allowing this math class. And look, the evidence is clear. You know, there's more kids of color in this math class versus this other math class, be it advanced or whatever. And the thing is, where's the evidence? And if that's really going on, why wouldn't you be saying, you know, how do we delve into this and really motivate our students of color so that they can be successful in math, as history has shown they're very capable of doing? And you know what I mean? It's really a different approach. So one is a systemic approach in which we have we're assigning assumptions that we've made, and we are doing confirmation bias where we're looking for evidence to support those assumptions,
yeah,
rather than solving the problem.
Yep.
Rather than getting behind individual kids and individual families and identifying skills and talents and empowering those kids in those pursuits.
Yeah. Yes, that's what we should be doing, is gearing it towards those individual students. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break. We will continue talking about real school choice here in Oregon, trying to get that on the ballot. And coming up, we'll talk to Mark Thielman about what some of the opponents have to say. And welcome back. We're talking with Mark Thielman. He is the superintendent of the Alsea School District, and he's also a candidate for governor on the Republican side. Got to get through the primary first. And Mark, we've been talking about real school choice here in Oregon, and I'm just terribly excited by this. I think this is such a great issue for Republicans to not only run on, but win on. I just see a lot of opportunities here. But in terms of putting this out there, putting this on the ballot, I'm sure that there are a lot of opponents to this. But the basic question that I would want to ask is, why shouldn't parents have the right to send their children to whichever school they believe is the best one for their child? I mean, what are the opponents' arguments against choice?
Well, a couple of things. So choice is a form of accountability. So, for example, if you don't allow choice, then parents are forced to leave their kids in the school. Then that's one piece of evidence that you don't have to worry about. If you're doing a mediocre or a poor job of educating kids, you know, we see that with a lot of things where, you know, like look at the increase in population in Texas. A lot of people move to Texas because they're voting with their feet, mm-hmm, because where they live, it's either too expensive or there's not opportunity, et cetera. So that's something that the teachers unions in particular are very wary of. And then there's an arrogance, too. And the arrogance is that teachers really, or at least many of them, a core of them, teachers and administrators, they seem to really believe that they know more or better than parents about what's best for their child's education.
Mm.
And what's funny is that it's really not one side or the other. It's supposed to be a healthy relationship in which parents and schools work together in support of children learning. And that's something you actually have to work at. And if you are going to create those healthy relationships, you actually have to assign parents value. And even the parents that might disagree with you or might argue with you or might want something different than you're arguing. And so, you know, we're in this divisive time where schools are saying, you know what? No. And you saw that in the Virginia election where,
yes,
the Democrat governor said, you know, parents don't know what's best for their kids in their education. What a disaster that was for that guy. You know, it's unfortunate I was driving when I heard that because I was laughing so hard I had to get off on the shoulder for a minute.
I don't doubt it.
You know, but you can see the hubris that comes with that. But what I want people to understand is that they really believe it. And to me, when you go to that level of hubris, you have closed your mind.
Yes.
And you've broken that relationship, that covenant that's supposed to exist, that healthy covenant between school and parents, because we're supposed to be working together. And when parents are at work or they send their kid to school, schools are supposed to act in place of the parent, which means we're supposed to say, what would the parents want?
Hmm.
But we don't do that. What we do is we say, oh, the parents aren't here. We're going to do what we want.
Yes. Yeah. That's really
important. And that's why school choice is so important.
Well, and as we talked about with both Donna Kreitzberg and also Dennis Lithcomb last week, this notion of competition, it really will force the public schools, and I know that they don't like this idea, or at least that's my perception of it, it will really force them to better themselves, that they're going to have to improve in order to attract those kids or keep those kids that would otherwise leave. And I think that helps everybody.
Well, imagine how scary that is for people that are entrenched in the current system.
Yeah.
Because if they have to embrace competition, that means that they have to change. And
admit that there's a problem.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. They have to concede that what they've been doing hasn't met the grade or hasn't worked. And what's funny is it's really not as scary as they think. You know, all you got to do is open your mind. Hmm. And, I mean, change is the one constant in our world, in our lives. You know, we always talk about not wanting things to change. Well, there's a reason for that, because everything constantly changes. And I know I just turned 51, and I tried to jump the fence the other day. My brain remembers doing it quite, you know, nimbly in my younger years. But I got over it, but it was far from graceful. But that's an example of that, you know, that I have to change my outlook because I'm getting older, and maybe I shouldn't be hopping over 4-foot fences. And so, you know, we do this naturally as we go through our life phases. We ought to have it as part of our school culture. And, you know, our demographics change, our cultural issues change, our hot button topics change. But the one constant is kids kind of, they're always kids. And that's the beauty of it. So it's a relationship. And then if you're open-minded, then competition becomes almost fun. Okay, well, how do we find what works? And hey, wow, we found something that's really resonating with parents. How do we amplify that? How do we capitalize on that so that we can do more good for kids and families? See, to me, that's more optimistic.
Sure.
And more fun. But that kind of concept does not occur, at least not in my statewide superintendent meetings. I can tell you that for sure.
Oh, I don't doubt it. But competition and innovation, that's what makes America great. One of the reasons why I love this, the notion of real school choice as an issue for Republicans to run on, is because it really is hard to argue against. I mean, you've already taken the issue of money off the table. It's not like public schools aren't going to get any money. So,
uh-huh.
I mean, you can easily go to somebody that's opposed to this and say, so are you honestly opposed to parents making decisions about where they send their kids to school or deny them the opportunity to access a better school? I just find this really hard to argue against. Aside from the money issues and aside from the, oh my gosh, we might have to compete, are there other arguments that they have against us that do make some kind of sense?
Well, if you look at the Democrat Oregon Party, the Oregon Democrat Party platform, in 2019, they added a staunch opposition to any kind of voucher, ESA, and there's a few other names that you know, labels they assigned. In terms of that their party will vehemently oppose any of these innovative ideas.
Hmm.
And that was one of the things that fueled my push to try to get a school choice thing together. You know, this thing is like Donna, you know, this has been a couple of years in the mix. It takes time to put something like this together. But the beauty of it is when you, I guess what I'm saying is when you push a concept like this out that challenges the status quo, my hope is that they attack me as a person, or they attack the ESAs as if they're vouchers, because that's kind of how they see it. This party, the progressives in the party, I should say, all they hear when you say ESA is vouchers. And which is why we didn't use that term, because, you know, vouchers it's been politicized. But an ESA is powerful because these are accounts that the parents don't directly get the money. It goes to a nonprofit organization, and then it pays out kind of like you would with an out-of-pocket you know, American Fidelity type account, or like an FFA or something, or a health savings account. And it works very similar with an education savings account, so that the parent gets to direct where those funds go based on the program that they pick for their child. And the nonprofit actually does the sends the check and does the managing of the account. And what's nice about that is it's very transparent. Parents don't just take the money and, you know,
pocket it.
Pocket it. And go to Vegas.
Take a vacation. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Exactly. That's, you know, there's some categories by which the money can be spent, and they're fairly broad and flexible. And but what's nice about it too is this is creating. There's no need for a giant ESA government division. See, because government, you know, look at the unemployment office. I just rest my case with that.
Really?
Nonprofits will make or break themselves based on their ability to efficiently manage these accounts for parents.
That's right. And I just love that aspect of things that, again, you've taken just another argument against this off the table. All right, let's go and take a break there. Come back. We'll be talking some more about Real School Choice with Mark Thielman. Stay with us.
This is the iSpy Radio Show.
And welcome back. Mark Thielman is our guest today. He is a Republican candidate for governor, but he is also currently the superintendent of the Alsea School District, which is southwest Corvallis, about halfway between Philomath and Waldport. And Mark, we talked a little bit about this briefly, but Virginia was flipped largely because of the reaction of parents who found out what their schools were actually teaching their kids on things like race. Kids were being told their white parents were, of course, racist because they were white, which is itself a rather racist statement. And by extension, all you white kids are racist because your parents are racist. I mean, it just blows my mind that that's your level of thinking when it comes to race. So have you, as a school superintendent, aside from the little bit that we talked about there in Corvallis, have you seen critical race theory or elements of it creeping into schools, public schools here in Oregon?
Yeah. The progressives in the media, in particular, you know, obviously I get interviewed by various media outlets, and the latest push is, you know, there's no evidence that CRT is taught, and my answer is always swift and very direct. Well, that's because they don't call it CRT; they call it anti-racist curriculum. You can go to the Oregon Department of Education website, click the equity link, and you will get a complete, you know, a whole meal full of critical race, basically critical race theory, now renamed anti-racist curriculum. And so people need to understand the sleight of hand. It is never okay for a political party to present a lie as in a manner that makes it seem like it's the truth. And the current push to do that with this critical race stuff is really, really, really frustrating, because it was CRT, now it's anti-racist, but they're also moving it again into what's called social emotional learning, or SEL. And you can see it in the news feed, you know, all this, the students are stressed, the teachers are stressed. Well, let's see, we fired 20% of teachers because they wouldn't vaccinate. We don't have enough substitutes. Schools are now being forced to stay open, but the Department of Education is closed. The government's still closed to people. And you can see the feel that I'm generating here. And then they wonder why, you know, parents had to lose their job or change jobs because their employer required vaccination. And now it's all being thrown out nationwide in courts. And you can see why there's a ton of stress in the system. All of that is created on purpose by these people to advance their cause, to say, see, now we have to move into social emotional learning. And how are we going to filter that? Well, we're going to say the most important criteria is race. And this is what frustrates me, is it's a solution looking for a problem rather than focusing on the actual problem, that we have government policies, educational department policies that are not popular. The vast majority of Oregonian parents and grandparents do not appreciate it. And then they're creating massive confusion for what we would call racially blended families like mine. And I've got a nephew and a niece that are African American. They were adopted from Ethiopia. I've got Hispanic daughter-in-laws and son-in-law. and I have mixed race grandchildren. And you know what we call them? We call them grandchildren.
That's right.
And because we don't want to emphasize, why would you emphasize the race thing? We're all human beings. And our education system should be the same way. All kids should be taught that they have a relationship with their own potential, that if they culture that relationship with their own potential, they can achieve their goals or beyond their expectations. And that is true for every human being in this amazing country called the United States. And we have an educational government, and we have educational ideologues in our education department that are trying to push the opposite. And the question I have is why? When the evidence is so obvious, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, but what they do is they triple down on it. And I think it's about this weird aberrant of psychology, like, well, I have to triple down on it. I have to deny being in denial, because if I don't, that means that I've been wrong and I can't live with that.
Yes.
The thing is,
yeah,
there's nothing more self-centered than that.
Oh, absolutely. And if you see race in everything, guess what? That makes you the racist. And I think that's a large part of what they have to struggle with, too, is they have their own inner demons of racism that they have to struggle with. And so they're reflecting that on everybody else. You know, you had talked earlier that there's this arrogance sometimes among teachers, that they know better than parents. If they're pushing this racist garbage on our kids, why is this even their business to go there? I mean, this is the domain of parents, not of schools, in my opinion.
Well, because about, you know, early 2000s, what there was these ideologues started to get frustrated that every time they got a little momentum, conservative members of the education world would come in and disrupt it, or parents would disrupt it. So finally, they started with the we're gonna bully everybody out, and you know, that's what the Courageous Conversation curriculum is that's designed to force employees and badger them out of their jobs if they don't agree with this woke kind of inane ideology. And you know, and that's why I'm a pariah. I am the only publicly declared conservative superintendent in Oregon. I know of no other that's gone out in public and said, I am a conservative. And I know there's more than just me, but most of my conservative colleagues are scared to death. They stay in their foxhole, they got their helmet on, and they don't stick their head up. And what it does, it allows this idiocy to infect our school systems. And then COVID hits, and parents suddenly got a full dose of it because they could see it in their own living rooms. And then how did the school systems react? They told parents they couldn't watch what their kids were learning.
Yeah, that was just shocking. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break. Coming back, we'll be talking about some of the mandates that are out there. We'll do that with Mark Thielman. Welcome back. We're talking with Mark Thielman. He's the superintendent of the Alsea School District, the only school that stayed open in 2020 and without one case of COVID tracked back to them, which is just a real slap in the face to all those school mandates the governor was imposing. And, you know, Mark, trust the science has been one of the most persistent lies over the last 2 years. If you dare to question the science, you're ridiculed and labeled misinformation. That's not how science works. That's not even how trust works. It is the business of science to question science. And instead, if you do question science, you're told to shut up and put your mask on because our science says so. So let's talk about some of these mandates that are out there. I know this has been a big issue for you since the governor decided to call you out publicly for daring to try to thwart her mandates in schools like masks and vaccines. And as I said, you managed to stay open despite the Governor Brown shirt showing up at your door. So in freer states all across the nation, we see better results than states like Oregon. Florida has the lowest COVID rates despite being the state with the fewest mandates. Now, just recently, the state Supreme Court of Pennsylvania repealed Governor Wolf's mask mandates for kids. Looking forward, do you see the governor start pulling back on some of these mandates, or is she going to double down until somebody else gets elected?
You will watch. She will begin to pull back because the tide has turned. So just today, I got an email from the Benton County Health Department talking about they're extending the shorter quarantine rules to unvaccinated students now. Now unvaccinated students can test, and if they're negative, they can stay in school. you know, as long as they're not symptomatic, et cetera, et cetera. That is a big shift from a week ago. And you know, the comedy of it is, you know, I obviously they sent OSHA to my school district, and, you know, we went at it. And all OSHA wanted to know is why I was testing to stay and doing the 3 to 5 day isolation rule. And all I'm saying is it's eerily similar what they're rolling out to what we were doing naturally in LC, because we were trying to maximize the number of kids who could safely stay connected to in-person learning. And again, you know, I was applying it to kids that weren't considered close contact, because if they're close contact, then you're under the mandate. And so this is really good news. I want everybody to understand the Democrat governor of Colorado is in the news today saying that declaring the pandemic over. And you know, the Omicron is not turning out to be the harbinger of death that they were worried about. And you know, if I'm sure eventually someone will pass, they're claiming a person died of Omicron in Britain, and now they're imposing Plan B and forcing boosters on everybody.
For but one person dying.
Yeah, and they've had tens of thousands of cases. It's 40% of cases in London. It's going to be 50% by tomorrow because it's much more contagious than even Delta. And one whole person dies, but notice they released no details about the death of that person. No. Were they over 80 years old?
Did
they
motorcycle have, accident.
Yeah, did they have secondary conditions? Did they get hit by a garbage truck and happen to have Omicron in their system, and, you know, or Omicron? And so the thing for me is this is the sleight of hand that we were talking about earlier. And these mandates have failed. And they failed largely because we've been dealing with a disease that has a dangerously high survival rate. And it's extremely high survival rate.
Yeah.
And it's not to say that it's not dangerous. What I am saying is that you shouldn't impose on 100% of people the kind of restrictions that and the pain and suffering that they've imposed, rather than just managing the disease, which is what they should have been doing from the get-go, and it's what Florida and Sweden have demonstrated works.
Yes, absolutely. It really bothers me, this notion that they're treating vaccinated kids versus unvaccinated differently. There was an article on World WND just a couple of days ago, and it was titled Ritual Humiliation. And unvaccinated children in Germany are being put in front of the classroom, and they've been asked each day to go in front of their class and state their vaccination status, resulting in applause for some and scorn for others. And the children who are unvaccinated must explain to their classmates why they are not. I find that very disturbing.
That's insane. This is my example, or I'll just rest my case. I think you just proved it. So tactics like that's called bullying.
Mm-hmm.
And it's government-sponsored bullying. No different than brown shirts. It's no different than declaring one section of society a pariah, you know, whether you're in a caste system like India or this COVID situation with vaxxed and unvaxxed. I mean, look at Austria. They're saying if you don't get vaccinated, you're going to you're going to face jail time if you're not able to pay the fine. See?
Yeah.
Now think about that. And so if you can't pay the fine, how's that equitable? Yeah, some people will and some people won't. But the thing is, they're talking about a vaccine that was designed for two variants ago.
Its
effectiveness is at best 40%.
Of this for a disease, as you say, that has a 99.8% recovery rate, even higher for kids, 99.998% recovery rate for kids. I mean, and for this, we've locked down society and destroyed and upended so many lives. I just continue to be amazed that this is where we're at. In terms of mandates, there was an interesting study. I don't know if you've seen this or not, but it was mentioned in, I think, the UK Daily Mail. And it was actually a study out of Brown University, which is hardly a bastion of conservatism. But they said that COVID rules are blamed, according to the study, are blamed for 23% decline in young children's cognitive development. It was along three cognitive tests, basically the equivalent of an IQ score there. And it found that face masks and other social distancing measures may have greatly impeded children's development. 23%. That's a massive drop.
Well, without getting too heady, you know, the formula in quantum information theory explains all this. So in other words, math deprived kids of stimuli, both the stimuli they receive from an educator or an adult or a teacher and vice versa.
And not oxygen.
There's other factors. The CO rates are much higher in the bloodstream.
Mm-hmm,
and,
mm-hmm.
And all of these factors converge together to create this wonderful, I'm saying that sarcastically, result of kids who have 23% less cognitive ability over their same age peers from pre-COVID. And the thing that I want people to understand is that they've been doing that assessment for well over 20 years, and kids have only gotten smarter in relation to their age over time. And we're talking about tiny increments over time. And then suddenly there's a big drop. So you have to ask what happened.
Yeah.
And the most impactful piece was the COVID shutdown, the stress and fear, the masking, and then the lack of oxygen for kids for hours at a time. And all of that comes together to affect the development of little children's minds and their ability to develop cognitively.
Yeah.
And what we're doing is so wrong. It is, you know, and I'm not going to go so far to say child abuse, but once you're aware of something you're doing in which you're doing it,
yes,
because you want to help.
Yeah, guess what?
That is now detrimental.
Yep.
You should stop doing.
Yep, that, in my opinion, that is abuse. All right, let's go ahead and take a break. We'll wrap things up with Mark Thielman after this. And welcome back. We're talking with Mark Thielman. He's superintendent of the Alsea School District, and also he is a candidate for governor on the Republican side. And Mark, since we've got you here, we ought to bring that up a little bit about you running for the Republican candidacy there for governor. I'd just like to mention your website real quick. It's markfororegon.com. That's M-A-R-C, and four is spelled out, F-O-R, markfororegon.com. I'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com as well. And we've been talking about competition is good for schools. We talked about this last week with Dennis Linthicum a little bit. What do you make of Betsy Johnson jumping into the race as an independent? What impact do you see that having?
I think it's good news for the Republican ticket, assuming that conservatives can hold together.
Yes.
I know that Newt Bueller went out and endorsed, you know, he's no longer a Republican. He endorsed Betsy and took a shot kind of in our direction here on the Republican side.
A lot of us have been saying that Newt Bueller has not been a Republican for a long time. It's not a surprise.
I appreciate you saying that, because I said, oh, good, he's finally outed himself.
That's right.
And the thing about it is that it is not extreme to want parents to be in charge of, to be the main, you know, navigators for raising their kids. It is not extreme to want family wage jobs so that parents can provide for their families and have good income and have a diverse life, a stable life that is not reliant upon government or welfare. That is not an extreme ideology. Betsy Johnson is kind of an amalgam because, you know, she hails from a conservative kind of area. She's always been a pro 2A Second Amendment. But in the end of the day, the vast majority of her votes are progressive votes. And I'm looking forward to getting to the general to start helping people understand that. She's a fantastic human being. I'm not going to judge her heart. I'm just going to look at her voting record. And to me, if we're going to move the dial here in Oregon, it has to be with a Republican in office, in the governor's office, and it has to be conservatives coming together and really making their voice heard, because, I mean, half of my campaign team is former Democrats.
Mm.
And, you know, I mean, just had one on the phone this morning, and, you know, and they've seen the light. Amen. And that's an example of the tide that's going here. And we cannot afford any more of this craziness, or none of our kids are going to learn math by the time they're in eighth grade.
Mm.
I mean, these are real impacts. They're going to be pushing bills in February to attempt to regulate homeschool, because the homeschool numbers are creeping up around 70,000. If they get to 100, that's one in seven kids are in homeschool. That's never happened before. And so we're in an interesting time when progressives get desperate, we know they triple down on bad policy. So
yes.
Things can only get worse and we can't have somebody in the middle. And I'll do a little progressive here and a little conservative there. That's not going to move the dial. We need to move in a very different direction.
Nope.
A direction that's freedom and liberty and parents' rights and school choice. I'm just rolling them out here, and law and order. We have to have that, that supports the homeless, that really creates real solutions to the housing crisis, which is we don't have enough housing and we have too much demand. You know, that kind of thing. We can solve these problems. They're very solvable. You just have to have the courage to take it on. And you have to be able to have a little grit in your belly. And I believe I'm the candidate that brings that to the table.
Well, I definitely think that real school choice is an issue that Republicans can win on, and not just governor, but also pick up seats in the Senate and the House.
Because, and absolutely,
if that was to happen, I mean, if you were to get a governor on, the in Republican hands and retake the House and the Senate, you could actually speed up the process of school choice. You could put it through as a legislative initiative, which does not require all the signature gatherings. I think that would be exciting.
Well, you're outing me, because there's a bill being drafted as we speak for the short February session to do just that. A couple of senators called me, and they were so excited. They said, can we just try this? So there is real momentum out there.
Good.
What I want folks to understand is parents and grandparents are the largest voting bloc in Oregon, not NAVs, not Democrats, and not Republicans. And I am a pro-parent candidate, pro-grandparent. I'm here to say I trust parents first and foremost. And really, the diversity of our amazing state is reliant upon allowing parents to raise their children as they see fit, not the way the government says all children should be raised.
That's right. That's exactly right. Government should be trusting the people. People shouldn't be forced to trust the government. All right, Mark, unfortunately, we have to leave it there. I want to thank you so much for your time. This has been great.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You know, in a way, government is always its own worst enemy because it always holds a monopoly on power. There's no competition to do better. You've heard Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council on iSpy Radio describe America as 50 test tubes of democracy. And that's true. But imagine if, as a citizen of the United States, you could choose which state's laws would govern you, regardless of where you live. Live in Oregon, but live under Florida's laws and governance. No mask mandates, no closing of your business, no closing of your church, no lockdowns of nursing homes so you can go visit your parents, be able to access the medicines you want or need. Or live under Oregon's oppressive regime, which is the opposite of all of that, where the governor, Kate Brownshirt, decides on a daily basis what new rules you will obey, not because of science, because that's what she says. How many people would choose to live under Oregon versus Florida? Choice. It's a wonderful thing. Let's work to make that happen here in Oregon. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.